Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Amidst the opioid crisis, Ohio is disproportionately exposed to the dangerous and destructive side of drug abuse. What's easy to forget are the stories of those who have overcome their addictions, creating a healthier future. After a long journey in recovery, Daniel Phillips joined Weiland's Market in 2014 as a butcher and has since worked his way up to co-owner. He recently shared his story in the Columbus Monthly Magazine in an essay titled Clean, The Point Where Life Ruled by Addiction Stops and Another Begins. And he joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been about 2 years since you became the co-owner of Weiland's Market in Clintonville. Congratulations on being co-owner.
Thank you.
Yeah. What was your journey like moving up the ranks at the market? I mean, tell me all the different roles you had.
So when I started, I had worked in kitchens for a really long time. I hadn't really done any meat processing except just a little bit in kitchens cutting steaks. And I just wanted to try it. I wanted to learn how to make sausage, learn that end of the industry. So I took just an entry-level position at Weiland's, doing the grinds, making sausage, making burger patties. And that's all I was really interested in doing at the time, was just learning this new thing.
Were you like a butcher apprentice?
I was. So typically we have like the meat cutters, and they're the ones that cut the pork chops and the steaks and the roasts and all that. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the production workers, which is where everyone starts. And actually, even if we hire a butcher with 20 years of experience, they start on production. They do the grinds. And that's what I was doing. So you take all the trim from the steaks and from the pork chops and the pork roast, all that, and you turn it into ground beef or sausage. So I try not to make it seem like it's a lesser position, because I think it does take as much skill as meat cutting, but it's definitely, you're kind of on the bottom.
Yeah.
And then I think I pretty quickly realized that Weiland's was a special place that I wanted to stay at. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, when I was in restaurants, I kind of bounced around a little bit, and I thought, okay, I'll do a year here and then see what I want to do. And within that first year, I think I knew that I want to stay here. This is what I want to do. And I don't think I had any sort of ambitions or delusions or anything else of I'm going to be able to rise like to the position that I'm in now.
Yeah.
Wasn't really on my mind, but just sort of, I think Weiland's has a dedication to its customers. The owners at the time, Scott and Jennifer, had a dedication to their employees. Mm. The people there had a dedication to the product and to the customers. And that I hadn't really seen that a lot at a lot of places that I worked. And so I kind of automatically knew I wanted to be there. And I was just lucky enough to now be in a position where I can be there more, or just be in a different role.
Yeah. And by be there more, a different role, you're a co-owner now.
Right.
So when did that come into focus for you, where you were like, oh, I can own a part of this?
So Scott Bowman and Jennifer Williams, and it was, Weiland's was started by John Williams in 1961. Jennifer is his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Her and her husband took it over. They owned it for, I want to say, like 12 or 14 years. I eventually became the meat manager, meat and seafood manager, and then kind of at the same time, another employee, Andy Russell, who started in produce the same way I started doing grinds. He started just stocking produce.
So you love the meat. He loves the veggies.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was busy kind of working his way up, even if maybe accidentally like me, to where he was grocery produce manager.
Mm-hmm.
Scott and Jennifer decided they wanted to retire.
Mm.
And
as they're allowed to do. Yes.
As they are allowed to do. And they have definitely earned, as they this would be a much longer show if I talked about all the things they did and the improvements they made. And
we'll do another show on them someday.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we'll do you today.
but they put in their time. They made the store what it is. They wanted to retire. And it's kind of the situation they were in. They could probably sell it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure someone would pay a lot of money to either turn it into a different store, or you get investors from the outside that are going to try to maximize how much money they can make and not really care about the ethos of the store. There are probably some exceptions, but I can't really think of any. Mm. Or they could keep it in-house, essentially, and so they decided to sell it to me and Andy to kind of preserve the legacy.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with one of the co-owners of Weiland's Market, Daniel Phillips. And we are talking about his addiction recovery journey and his journey from being a butcher there to now a grocery store owner. So you recently wrote this essay for Columbus Monthly Magazine. It's quite emotional, also inspiring. It's called Clean, The Point Where Life Ruled by Addiction Stops and Another Begins. Why did you decide to write this and share your story?
I wrote it under duress. Someone convinced me to write it. Jill Moorhead, who's also a writer for Columbus Monthly, who works with Weiland's Market, she encouraged me to write it. I didn't really want to, but I kind of begrudgingly did. Mm. And that's, I don't like talking about myself. I'm not ashamed of where I've been in my life, or it's not like I can't dredge up this deep, dark stuff. But I think there's just so many more interesting things to talk about than talk about myself. And so I don't really like doing it.
Well, thank you for coming outside of your comfort zone. I'm sure this right now.
It is uncomfortable, but it's also, if I have the opportunity, I have to admit to the fact that I'm in a unique position to maybe give hope to some people that have dealt with addiction or some family members. I feel like everyone at least has loved someone that's dealt with addiction. Mm. So I kind of have to suck it up and try to do what I can to maybe give them a little bit of hope.
Yeah. So you talk in the piece about why you're writing this, and you hope that others can gain from your story, both users and non-users. I mean, what do you hope you want to teach someone, that they can become a butcher someday?
That it's messy. Mm-hmm. That it's no. And I think I mentioned it in the article. If people are waiting for rock bottom, there is no rock bottom. Mm. It can always get worse, just like it can always get better. It's not. You might not wake up one day filled with this conviction that you're going to turn your life around by God, and then everything is different. And then even if you do have that moment, or when you do get to the point where you want to fix things, there's a lot of people that don't trust you. You have messed up relationships. You possibly have a criminal record. It could be hard to find a job, all these things. So even when you get to the point where maybe you feel internally, I want to do this forever, I don't ever want to do that again, I can't do that again, it's a slog. It's not a straight line. I mentioned in the article that I've relapsed several times. And, every time I got clean, I thought I was going to stay clean. Mm. And every time I relapsed, I thought I was going to stay out there till I died. Mm. And that could be a week, a month, or, maybe I just used until I'm, old and then I die. I don't know. But it's not. And that's sort of the thing with the article, or whether it's for me with Weiland's, or for work in general with labor, with meat cutting, where it is very exact in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. This is right, this is wrong, this is how you do it, this is not how you do it. And I think the journey through recovery is not really like that. It's not, things are so much less clear in life in general, and especially in trying to get clean. And so I guess if I want to say anything, it's that it's going to be messy. Mm-hmm. And if someone fails, that doesn't mean that they're going to fail forever. But there's always the chance. Everyone that is using has the chance to at least try to get better. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of erase the line between me as I sit here and, I've done something with my life, you could say, and then there's someone that is in active addiction right now, that doesn't have a job and is maybe stealing, that is sticking needles in their arm every day, And there's only a chronological difference between those two people. Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember that they also have a chance.
Mm. In your essay, you speak a lot about your recovery journey. You talk about relapsing, as you mentioned. But you joined Weiland's right around 2014, and it's right around a time when you became clean and stayed clean. Did the market impact that? I mean, did the market impact that journey and to stay drug-free?
I think that work has always been important to me. If I'm putting myself into something, it's highly gratifying, and it feels purposeful. It feels meaningful. And then especially in something like Weiland's or customer service in general, you're working for a paycheck, but you're also working to do something that has nothing to do with you. You're giving this service. You're doing this for the customers, and you're interacting with them. And I think that that does help give purpose, mm-hmm. meaning. I don't know what I don't want to.
Yeah, in the piece, you also talk about times whenever you were out of money, you had no place to stay, and you talk about being truly hungry, right? You didn't have food. You were truly hungry.
Yes.
Is that hunger connected to picking a grocery store career?
Yeah, and I always worked in kitchens too, and I think there's with something like food, and it's probably true of other things. There's like the abstract idea of it, and mm-hmm. I've done, you know, some fine dining where you start to get into the abstract concepts of food and flavor profiles and what makes something balanced, enjoyable, and it's kind of, there have been books written about it, and mm-hmm. people get really, really minute, and I can get really minute when I'm cooking or when I'm cutting, and you don't cut like this, you cut like this, and I know it seems like it's exactly the same thing, but it's not. And then there's the literal the literal food, the literal putting food in your body so that you don't die. Mm. And they are, and the abstract comes from that. And I do think it gives me a certain appreciation for food because I put food in my body so that I didn't die. Mm. And I don't recommend anyone seeking out that experience. But it does remind you that this is something to nourish you. It nourishes on a deeper level, I think, than people realize. And it also makes the idea of people sharing meals together, like providing food for people to cook and come together to eat it and enjoy it together. The fact that we can get past the eating food so that we don't die, and now it can turn into this communal social, this intimate thing between people when they can eat together.
Well, and I think it connects nicely for you working at a neighborhood grocery store rather than, because you could be a butcher at a Kroger or a Giant Eagle or whatever, but you're at Weiland's, right? So I wanted to, just before we run out of time, talk about your plans for the future of Weiland's. I mean, as an owner, do you have future plans for the market? Are you going to keep things pretty much the same because it's been working? Tell me more about your plans for Weiland's.
Weiland's has always, I don't think it's gone through a lot of really big changes. Mm-hmm. It changes incrementally. I think we'll continue to change incrementally. I think Scott and Jennifer were really good about making these small decisions that over time added up into, you know, just a nicer experience. And we will keep doing that. If something big comes along and we think customers are going to benefit, we'll do it. But for now, it's just keep the customers happy and the ball rolling.
How does it feel working at a small, independently owned market, you know, whenever there's the Krogers and Walmarts of the world?
It feels great. It's very rare. And I've always been so proud to work at Weiland's, mm-hmm. to be a part of Weiland's. And I still feel, when I think about how proud I am, I don't think I'm so proud to own Weiland's. I think I'm proud to be at Weiland's, to work mm-hmm. at Weiland's. It's just, it's a very, very unique place. And I've also always said, I don't want to work at a grocery store. I want to work at Weiland's.
Okay. What's your pitch for people listening right now? Why should they try a Weiland's instead of a Kroger?
We have a lot of, I would say, higher quality products. We have more niche products. We have a lot of regional favorites. We have a lot of trendy things that are new. And we have a staff that's completely and totally dedicated to making sure you get a good experience and that you find the products you need.
Well, we have been talking with the co-owner of Weiland's Market, Daniel Phillips. We talked about his addiction recovery journey and his years of experience at Weiland's Market, where he worked his way up to now being the co-owner. Thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with an author who is passionate about mental health advocacy. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. There is still a stigma around women's mental health. Women commonly struggle with anxiety, depression, eating disorders, and other hormonal changes. And many women go undiagnosed and untreated. Mental health advocate and author Akia Redd supports women navigating identity shifts through life coaching, advocacy work, and her writing. And she joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Akia.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
So your newest book is called Divorcing Religion, Finding God.
Correct.
It was just published. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Tell us about this book and what inspired you to write it. I mean, because it's a powerful title, Divorcing Religion, Finding God. Why this book?
Well, I mean, I've been on this deconstructing my faith journey, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, becoming more popular of a phrase for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And specifically related to the book, there was someone that passed away that was very close to me and my family. Mm-hmm. And he and our family lost contact very late in my teens, because he started developing these other ideas around religion and theology and all of that. And it wasn't accepted into the Pentecostal church where I was raised in. Mm. And so when he passed away, it brought up a lot of, I think, emotions and memories that some were not great. Some were fond memories, not of him, but just of my whole upbringing in the church. And so I said, I think I'm ready to heal this part of me. And in the process of healing, I started writing. Mm.
So the religious trauma, I mean, is that something that you noticed affecting people? Because you've done for years, you've done a lot of life coaching, advocacy work. Does religious trauma come up often?
Yes, it does. Mm. I have noticed it not only with my own journey, but with other people that I talk to, even if it's like the eating disorder space. A lot of people who are recovering from an eating disorder or body image stuff, they will always reference religious trauma as a result of them not feeling good in their bodies. A lot of sexual abuse survivors, same situation. And so I think that it was a very common thread. We all had that in common. And so in the book, I actually tell stories of other people and interviewed people for this particular book. Mm.
And you specifically mentioned struggles women face with religion.
Yeah.
What are some of the ways that you notice that, like, women are more disproportionately impacted by religious trauma? Is there a reason there?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, like, the state of where we are today, honestly, with, you know, a lot of the Christian nationalist stuff that, you know, you see popping up all over the place. There's a lot of patriarchy and misogyny in religion, where, like, the man is centered, and especially, you know, the particular denomination that I grew up in, again, which is like a cross between Pentecostal and apostolic, we always refer to the man of God. And there's always this. And then women kind of just serve. And we are always looked at as the helper or the person who serves and does all the free labor in the church and all of that. And so we really aren't taught as we're raised that we have any autonomy. In particular, even when it comes to marriage, we are to be underneath the man always and not alongside as a partner.
You, in the book, you share a lot of tips. You share some advice on how to build a healthier relationship with spirituality.
Yeah.
You know, to deal and to heal from the religious trauma. We can't go through every tip in the book.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Can you share one of those tips with us right now of how to basically, you know, have a healthier relationship spiritually?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I think the misnomer is that people will see the title and be like, okay, how does that work?
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's some of the feedback that I've heard. They love the title, but they're like, how does that even work? And so the thing that I say most to people is all of us have questions about things that we've been taught, especially when it comes to spirituality, religion, God, the universe, whatever we call God or refer to God as. And I just would say first tip would be lean into the questions. Allow yourself to have permission to be curious. That for me is what led me down this path, was just deciding to lean into the questions and not be scared of them and not feel like God is intimidated or afraid of my questioning.
And what do you recommend trying to do it on your own? I mean, do people need a church? Do they need a spiritual leader? Like, can you do it yourself?
So for me, and I'll just say this is my opinion, I think where we get into trouble is looking outside of ourselves. I think that so many people, and women especially, right? Like, we're taught to look for external validation and look outside of ourselves. But I really do think that we were all born with intuition. We were all born with the answers within us. So I would say, no, you don't need anybody else because you already have the answers inside of you.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with author and mental health advocate Akia Redd. So you've written three other books, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your first one, Authentically You, is tailored to younger girls. Can you tell us about you decided at some point, I'm going to write books. So why that one?
Funny. Yeah. I mean, I started blogging about my mental health journey and I think that there was just a demand for more content. Mm-hmm. And so actually the first one was Be Free, Be You.
Oh, okay.
And then Authentic You was the second one.
Okay.
Which is the one you're referring to for the younger girls.
Yes.
And to be honest, I think I was going through such a metamorphosis in my own womanhood journey, if you will, that I wanted to write something for girls that I needed to read when I was between the ages of 12 and 17. And so it was really me writing to my younger self. And that's what led me to that book.
What did you tell your younger self? Give me a synopsis.
Oh, gosh. I told my younger self to trust myself. I told my younger self that I don't have to, you know, perform and to be accepted. But I will tell you a little secret, and I will tell the listeners this. I was writing that and I still hadn't caught on to it yet.
Yeah.
It's kind of like it was this very abstract thing, and I was like working my way, like trying to convince myself, you know what I mean?
You were writing to yourself.
I was writing to myself.
Yeah.
And that was the interesting thing about that book. And then, you know, a lot of life happened in between that one and the third, and we got here.
Yeah. Well, in your books, in all your books, you talk through mental health struggles. You talk about your personal experiences. You put yourself into your books. How does sharing your own struggles help you when you're helping others? Because you do a lot of work as a life coach. So how do they appreciate? Do you feel like you need to share yourself to help someone?
You know, I feel like when I'm writing, and when I'm coaching, there's two different versions, right, that I show up as. And as a writer, I do feel that it's important for me to share my story, because I feel like when people are reading it, I don't want them to be so much in their head mm-hmm. and trying to analyze it as much as I want to get to their heart. Mm-hmm. And so for me, sharing your story and getting to the heart of somebody is really like one of the things that you have to do as a writer, because they need to see you to mm-hmm. feel seen, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And me as a life coach, it's rare that I'll bring myself up as a life coach because mm-hmm. of how I've been trained. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to Gestalt Institute and I got trained there. And I just remember learning, like, just try not to overshare your story, right? Mm-hmm. If it's something that's relevant, you have to get consent first with the person and make sure that they're okay hearing your story. And so what's interesting is a lot of my clients have found out about me through the work that I've done. Mm-hmm. So they know a little bit and they will ask, like, have you ever experienced this? And mm-hmm. then that gives me permission to kind of go into it. But in my life coaching sessions, I really try to keep it about the client. Mm-hmm.
Tell me the difference between life coaching and therapy.
Oh, that's a good one. Therapy is, the way that I put it is, you know, you work from the present to where you are, and you go back mm-hmm. and see how your past has gotten you to where you are. With life coaching, it's more about, okay, where am I now and where do I want to be 5 years from now? Mm-hmm. And so it's more like now to the future. And so I always tell people when I'm starting the coaching relationship is we drive right to the past, but we don't park there. Mm. And that's, as a coach, how I keep myself even out of doing something that I am not, you know, trained to do.
Okay. Well, driving to the past for just a second.
Yeah.
You became a mental health advocate because you finally decided to advocate for yourself.
100%.
Yeah. So tell us about your journey, you know, realizing you had generalized anxiety disorder and when you decided you were like, I need to step up for myself.
Yeah. So anybody who has read my books or is going to get introduced to my work will find out very quickly that I had a very chaotic childhood upbringing. And so there were lots of times that I would be woken up at 3 or 4 in the morning with like just a lot of chaos going on in my house. Mm. And so what I found out is that if you don't deal with the past will deal with you. Mm. And I would wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning, just all of a sudden in this panic. And I didn't know what the heck was going on. And so I didn't address it. I didn't deal with it. And then the waking up started, then it went into tremors. Mm. And I started uncontrollably shaking. And I just thought I was sick. I thought I was getting some kind of, you know, nervous system disorder. I mean, I didn't know what the heck was happening.
Yeah.
I didn't have language for it at that time. And that was back in 2016. And so I finally went to check it out at the doctor. And the doctor was like, you're absolutely fine. Your blood pressure is through the roof. And I'm going to sit down and tell you that you have generalized anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And I was just like,
you even thought about that?
No, yeah. I didn't even have the language for it because growing up as, one, a Black woman, we don't talk about mental health. Number two, I was in a religious household. So
you should be able to pray it away.
Yeah. Black, religious. We don't. What is mental health? What? Mm. You know what I mean? And so I just was convinced that I had demons. Mm. Right. And that I was under spiritual attack. Ah. Right. And so I did try to pray it away. And the more I tried to pray, the worse it got because nothing was working. And so then I would get more panicked. Mm. And so I finally took what the doctor said, went home, thought about it. Was like, OK, do I want to treat this? Like, how do I want to, you know? And by the way, I had been in therapy for 2 years before because I thought I needed to go, you know, because of some of the things I was like reenacting with my kids. So this tremor and stuff didn't even show up until 2 years after I was already in therapy working on some other stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, tell me specifically about the coaching of Black women.
Yeah.
Do you feel that Black women have particular barriers to work through to get the mental health help for Black women specifically?
Yeah, I do actually. And to be frank, I've experienced some discrimination, you know, in healthcare myself, as it relates to mental health. You know, it's very difficult sometimes for Black women to get the help that they need because there is this belief that we are strong. Mm. And it's not because we necessarily want to be, but it's because we have had to be strong. Mm. It's because we were raised by other Black women who just instilled in us, like, you can't let anybody see you sweat. You can't break. You have to keep going, because if you don't, what's going to happen? Mm. So, yeah, we have not been afforded the privilege to be soft, to be feminine, to not be strong. And then also understanding that there's a both and there. Just because I am vulnerable, just because I cry, just because I experience mental health challenges, doesn't mean that I'm any less strong. There is strength in the vulnerability.
You have you have books, but then you also have what's called the Rooted with Red, your coaching platform.
Yes. Yeah.
So who is that tailored to? Who are you reaching out to with Rooted with Red?
Women. Mm-hmm. Women between, like, really women that are in a transitional phase of their life. Mm-hmm. I know what that's like, you know. And sometimes, like, when you're raising kids and your kids start to get a little bit older and you've defined yourself through motherhood, through being a wife, or just women who maybe that's not their life with a husband and kids or a partner and children, but it is, they've defined themselves through their career and they're like, what's next? What I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to overfunction. I don't want to overperform. Mm. So I work with women to get them to tap into their inner self, their worth, what they want their life to look like moving forward. And yeah, so.
Well, and you've been featured by many brands, national news, local news.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be recognized that way? I mean, do you like all the attention?
I think no, because, like, I know it probably doesn't seem like it. And for people listening, they're like, there's no way she's shy. But I am really, like, very shy. I kind of don't like that. And I also don't, I like to pop out and do, like, appearances and then, like, go back, because I really am an introvert.
You're going to go hide after this?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. Yes. So, I mean, the attention is, you know, it feels surreal, honestly. And it makes me, I guess, happy that I'm impacting so many people with my story. But yeah, you know, it's really strange when I, like, will walk in somewhere and I see, like, this group of people staring at me, and they're like, they walk up to me and they're like, we've been following you on social media forever. And I'm like, you know, so it's always neat.
Well, at least they come up to you. It'd be worse, I guess, if they just, like, looked at you from afar. And,
yeah. Because who knows, like, how many people actually do that, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, just to end on, if there's someone listening right now who might be suffering from anxiety, might be having some mental health issues, but they're hesitant to get help, they don't know how to even ask for help, what would you say to them?
So honestly, I would say, one thing I would say don't do is don't Google.
Yeah. That's always good advice.
Don't Google. You know, chat is good, but don't kind of overdo it on the chat, you know, GPT, you know, and diagnose yourself. What I would say is go speak to a provider and tell them your symptoms and what you're experiencing, and then have them go from there. And if there are any questions that you have, I would just say that's when you start to do your research. But don't do it beforehand, because, you know, if you do it beforehand and you are struggling with anxiety, yeah, it's going to make it worse.
Mm. Well, and then tell me about the idea of, like, the therapy and the life coaching. Maybe you need both to balance, because you got to maybe deal with the past
100%
to get to the future.
Yeah. So, usually when I take on a client, I do have a form that I have them fill out, and I will ask them to give me, like, a brief, you know, like, have you worked with a therapist before? You understand that this isn't therapy. And in our initial conversation, if I pick up that there's, you know, something that they need to work on, I'll recommend that. I do refer out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm in the process of a life coaching agreement and I feel like somebody needs to go, you know, see a therapist, I will suggest that often. So, you know, it is not an either or. It is a both and sometimes. And, you know, it's completely okay.
We've been talking with author Akia Redd about mental health advocacy, her life coaching, and her newest book, Divorcing Religion, Finding God. Thank you for joining us today, Akia.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to meet the new executive director of the Reeb Center, a community center serving the South Side neighborhood of Columbus. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. For more than 10 years, the Reeb Center, a community hub on the south side of Columbus, has been providing residents with social services, resources, and community events. Just recently, the center welcomed its new executive director, Karim Jackson. He's been working as a nonprofit leader and in public service for more than 15 years, and he joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Karim.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy.
So congratulations on the new position.
I appreciate it.
I know it's brand new for you. What led you to this opportunity? How'd you end up the executive director here?
Sure. So I've been in this role for not even 2 weeks yet, but I have already been doing a lot of great work with our team and partners. But what led me to the role is, you know, I grew up here in Columbus. My family has roots here. And living under a roof with my parents both, you know, serving the community, one being an educator and my mother being a social worker. I just grew up seeing the importance of kind of the saying, it takes a village to raise a community. Mm-hmm. And with my professional experience, I've worked a lot with nonprofit organizations, the public sector, and really development throughout the lifespan of people here in Columbus. This was kind of just a perfect opportunity to bring all my personal passions and my professional experience all together in one role.
Did you find this job or did this job find you? Did someone reach out to you?
Someone did reach out to me through some conversations with some of my mentors and friends out in the community. The position became available. I was kind of recommended to have a conversation with the role. So they did reach out to me, and I could be more, you know, grateful for the opportunity.
I don't know where in Columbus you grew up or anything, but had you ever been involved with the Reeb Center before this, before taking on this role?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, I grew up on the east side of Columbus, in the East Haven area. But previously, I worked for the city of Columbus dating back to 2012. And the Reeb Center was founded in 2015 with city of Columbus being really their first partner. So at the time, I was working in the Department of Neighborhoods. So I was very familiar with the work that the Reeb Center was planning to do once they opened and really have been involved in some, you know, form or fashion over the last 10 years. So very familiar with the work they've been doing in the and the, you know, the great impact they've had on the south side of Columbus.
And so the Reeb Center, it calls itself a hub of many things. It's a hub for several different community resources. Can you share some of those resources? Tell people what the Reeb Center does.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, we're a hub for the South Side. So you know, and our, you know, your listeners know that, you know, many people come from different backgrounds and experiences, and sometimes they need support and you know, just a hand to help them get from point A to point B. And to try to, you know, mitigate some of those barriers, we've brought in a lot of different nonprofit and public sector partners under one roof at the Reeb Center. So from, you know, youth development and workforce to, you know, healthcare. So what else do we have? So we have, you know, 10 partners here at the building. So for any gamut that you have for, you know, housing situations that you need to have support on, we kind of cover the whole gamut of sources that that Southside community needs.
It's become kind of like a one-stop shop, right? Like,
absolutely.
You can get help with a lot of different things. What, I mean, do people of all ages come to you?
Yes, we welcome all ages. So we actually have an early learning center at the Reeb Center. So, you know, literally pretty much from birth up to, you know, your entire lifespan, we have services that can provide help to you.
The early learning center, is that like a daycare or a preschool or what is the...
Yes, Columbus Early Learning Center, for the South Side. But yes, it's early learning child. I believe they start at 6 weeks up to preschool.
Well, and there's lots of events as well. I mean, are there any particular events that you've been to or events coming up that you think really define what the Reeb Center does?
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, actually, we had our Rooted in Reeb annual fundraising event where I was able to actually kind of be announced as the new executive director and meet all of our great partners and supporters. So this is an event that, you know, happens each year in May. This coming Saturday, actually, we have one of our summer series with our partnership with our music and Americana and folk partner. So Saturday at 2 o'clock at the Reeb Center, you can come out to a free community event, listen to some great music, and get engaged with the community.
Yeah. And I was looking online. I've never actually been to the Reeb Center, but I've driven past the building. It's a beautiful building. I know you're new, but do you know much about the building?
Yeah. So the Reeb Center was actually the Reeb Avenue Elementary School. Mm-hmm. And once they closed, it sat vacant for some years. And then I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Southside Settlement House. Mm. So the Southside Settlement House provided a lot of different resources and support for that Southside community. But unfortunately, they had to shut their doors in 2011. Mm. So we have some great, you know, visionary founders that, you know, made a commitment to figure out how to kind of fill that gap for those services that were no longer on the Southside. And that's how the Reeb Center was founded. But again, going back to the Reeb Center roots, it started out as an elementary school that has now been repurposed to provide service to the community in a different way.
Okay, so if it was an elementary school, you have lots of rooms to do lots of different things in, right?
Absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. We have space. We have gym and a multi-purpose space that is available to the community. If you have, you know, events, meetings, or whatnot, you can definitely reach out to us and come share in the impact that we're having on the South Side.
People can also rent it out. Is that or
yes.
use it?
Yeah. Yes.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the Reeb Center, a community hub in the South Side of Columbus with their new executive director, Karim Jackson. What are you looking forward to most in this role as executive director?
Like I said, since my first 2 weeks, and these first 2 weeks have been amazing. We have a great team, very passionate team, small but mighty. And you can't imagine the amount of work that they're doing to help the South Side. We're talking about serving 500 to 700 people within our building, along with our partners each day. Over 2,000 services have provided just in this calendar year. So you can imagine, the great work that they're doing, but also to connect more deeply with our tenant partners that are doing services outside of our Reeb Center. Like I said, we have 10 tenant partners that do amazing work, and to really bring that work together for a collaborative approach is one of the areas that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah. So, I mean, whenever you interviewed for the job, I'm sure you had to talk about hopes and dreams and plans. Can you share, something that maybe you aspire to, even if it's just a 5-year goal or something like that?
Absolutely. I'll share one of our kind of, big picture dreams is Columbus, Southside is not, uncommon to a lot of the issues that many residents across Columbus face. Hopefully I plan to do my job very well and along with our partners, create a model that can be duplicated throughout this entire city. So we're not just saying, the Southside, community has something that they can, go to when they have a time of need or need some support. But we'll be able to kind of have this blueprint where we can duplicate this in other sides of the city. So every resident in Columbus and Central Ohio has somewhere to go when they need that, helping hand.
Okay. So do other communities lack having something as multi-purpose as the Reeb Center maybe?
Correct. So there's, plenty of, over hundreds of nonprofits and, community work that's going on, doing great work. But like you said, our goal is to really break down some of those barriers, having, community members, they might have to have 3 different services at 3 different places. But again, bringing those services under one roof to break down those barriers so they can get, that they need more efficient, the help that they need more efficiently.
So you have more than 15 years of past experience in nonprofits, public service work. You mentioned you worked for the city neighborhoods department. How have all those experiences shaped what kind of leader you are today?
Great question. I think truly, working with people of all backgrounds, of all experiences, truly has kind of taught me that you meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. With leadership, it's easy to tell people what to do, but it's harder to show them with a kind of a compassionate feel when it comes along with that. So that is one of my approaches to really show my team and, the people that I'm working for and with that I'm in this with them, not just to sit in the office and give directives, but even my personal background, has helped shaped who I am and the leader I am to understand that when you're in this type of response, you have this type of responsibility, that you really have to have a connection with the people before you can make any type of, you know, directions or anything like that.
I read that before the Reeb Center, you were the senior program officer for My Brother's Keeper,
yes.
Columbus. So that's an initiative that was started by President Obama to help support young boys of color. Can you highlight a little bit about your time there with My Brother's Keeper?
Sure. So I have a kind of a unique experience with My Brother's Keeper. Back in 2017, when Mayor Ginther and Council President Hardin kind of accepted the challenge from President Obama at the time, I was the first program manager to kind of get that uplifted through the Department of Neighborhoods. Did that for a couple of years. Then I went on to some other experiences and then returned recently to kind of pick back up and kind of expand what those services were doing for the boys and women of color in Columbus. Just recently before I departed that role, we had a statewide summit called the Idea Makers Summit, where we brought in boys from, of course, Columbus, but across the state with their other MBK chapters. And we gave the opportunity for the boys that were in attendance to create a blueprint of success for their communities. So that was, you know, an event where over 100 boys attended. They were to take what they created at that event and back to their programs and neighborhoods to continue that work.
You also founded the Jackson Youth Empowerment Foundation. Tell me about that organization.
Yes. I co-founded that with my father, Jesse Jackson, who I shared was an educator, coach, now retired. But that's, you know, just a way that we can continue to give back to our community. In the past, we have done direct programming with, with sports development, along with professional and career exposure. But as, you know, our time and our careers have shifted, we moved more to kind of a foundational model where we now support through scholarships to students that are attending HBCUs, as well as those that are going out to have experiential learning but may able to not be able to afford the cost or whatnot. So we provide some small grants for them to experience that.
You mentioned the sports, like you have an interest in sports. You have past experience also in sports management. How did the skills you've learned from your interest in sports management, how does it reflect in your current career?
Yeah, so I'm a lifelong athlete, played college at basketball at Wilberforce University. But, you know, playing sports pretty much my entire life. You know, that common answer, you have to learn how to work with other people, have to work through adversity, have to have those tough conversations with yourself when things might be going the way that you like to, but figure out how to kind of get out of your own way sometimes. And all those, you know, kind of have filled into my personal life as well and my leadership style, going back to one of your questions earlier.
Yeah. Are you going to incorporate some of this sports love into the Reeb Center? I don't know if the Reeb Center has sports programs.
I share a kind of fun story. One of our partners here in the building. So we do have a gym at the Reeb.
Yeah.
So one of our partners, during the lunch break, they go down and shoot some hoops. So I was able to connect with one of our partners over some basketball shots last week. So that's just a unique way, where you can use sports or unconventional ways to connect with people.
Yeah, well, since you played in college, the partner was probably like, wait a second, you're too good at this.
they weren't too bad themselves, so okay. They gave me a challenge.
Do you think you might add some maybe youth sports or anything like that to the Reeb Center programming, use the gym in different ways?
Yeah, I do have some thoughts, but I'll actually share one of our partners, Greater Columbus Community House. They just announced a partnership with PPG led by Coach Shaq, former coach from Afrocentric ladies basketball. So they have a partnership, and I actually reached out to her to learn more about that and see if that's something that we can kind of bring over to the Reeb Center as well.
And for 7 years, you worked with I Know I Can. You help students become college ready. You're a busy guy. I don't know how you have lots going on. Will you be creating something similar to that at the Reeb Center for Youth in the Neighborhood? I guess first we should say, what is I Know I Can?
So, yeah, I know Ken is a college and career access program. They serve several of the districts here in Central Ohio. While my time there at Ken, I was working as a college manager for a few years, as well as assistant director of development. Have very personal ties to I Know Ken. Graduating from Walnut Ridge, they supported me with some grant opportunities for me to attend college, as well as my dad being a volunteer for their organization well before I was aware of what they were doing. So I have some strong ties there. But one of our goals, again, is to not duplicate the great work that is going on in Columbus, but to bring those partners in that are already doing the great work. So, of course, we'll be having some conversations to see where their services can be provided to our residents on the South Side.
All right. And I look forward to you being at a basketball game in the South Side, too. Yes.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Karim Jackson, the new executive director of the Reeb Center. It's a resource hub and community center on the South Side of Columbus. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me and allowing me to share about the Reeb Center.
And you've been listening to All Sides. This is Fascinating Ohio on 89.7 NPR News. And if you missed any part of today's show, listen back at our website, wosu.org/allsides. You can subscribe to the All Sides podcast. Every episode is available for free in our mobile app. Be sure to like the show on Facebook, and you can follow us on Instagram. You can see some pictures from today. If you go to Instagram, our handle is at allsideswosu. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for listening. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.